Hello, and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that is continually searching for the finest minds to share their passions and thoughts on the natural world around us. Today, we're joined by Lucy McRobert, writer, editor, columnist, campaigner, co-founder of the Youth Nature Network, a focus on nature, mother, and something I didn't know, also a qualified marine mammal medic. I'm exhausted after that. That's a lot of stuff to explore, so we'd better get right on with it. Welcome, Lucy. How are you?
Hello, Kerry. I'm much better after that little ego boost that you've just given me. I suddenly feel quite qualified for a Friday afternoon when we're recording this.
Well, I know you're qualified and you know you're qualified. And we're going to show everyone out there how qualified you are. It does sound like your days are pretty busy with that roster of activities.
Oh, they can be. They can be incredibly tedious, to be honest. It's one of the great things about being freelance and working from home is last year, when the world ended for everybody else, I just kind of carried on like normal in many respects. Everyone realised what it was like to be completely antisocial and realised how marvellous it was at the same time. But yeah, I do a lot of different things. I juggle a lot of different bits of work alongside, as you said, mothering. Then I'm delighted that you included mother in that list of qualifications and achievements at the beginning there, because that is a huge part of my life now, something that takes up a huge amount of my time. But it's also the most important thing that I do, giving my little girl a wild childhood. And we do everything we can as a family to make sure that she has really exciting natural experiences from morning, noon and night. She goes to a forest school nursery, and it's just great to bring her along on all of our wild adventures.
Well, you know, the one thing you would say is kids often rebel. Let's hope she doesn't rebel against nature and things being brought up with it. I doubt it very much, because I think there's, as we'll discover in this discussion, something incredibly special. Nature, nurture, they're very close words, because there is some semblance of truth in that. Nature is nurture. So I'm fascinated to find out what you get up to. And what's a forest school then?
Oh, a forest school. It's a way of teaching children that they use now at different age groups. So nursery all the way through, I think, to kind of high school age years, 9, 10, 11. And essentially, it's an immersive experience for children where they go outside and they learn about proper curricular activities, but using natural resources and the natural world. So it's largely based outside. They have a lot of mindfulness activities. They do a lot of arts, crafts, creativity, exercise, experiencing nature using all their senses. It's a really lovely way of learning, actually. And you kind of think, wow, if we all just took our time to do our own forest school-based activities, maybe adults would be a lot happier as well. Because kids just thrive in this environment. It's so creative. It's so exciting for them. And I have noticed such a change in her development since she's been going. It's just a really great way to teach kids about themselves and about socializing and about nature. It's the whole package.
The thing is with kids, I always find, and I think this is true, that kids are connected with nature pretty much from the start. And actually, half of the structure of modern society is a de-learning process, if that makes sense. Do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with you. When I look at the way that she interacts with the natural world, I find it's actually quite different to me. And hers is just so much more pure and instinctive. We learn all these things as we grow up, that things that we have to be scared of, things that we have to worry about, the ways that we should react to things based on our social experiences rather than our lived experiences. So a classic example at the moment is phobias. I'm not great with spiders. I don't have a full-blown fear, but I'm not great with the big ones. Georgie's just not scared of them at all. And it's been an actual unlearning process for me so that I don't instill that fear in her. I've had to really get hold of my own problems and deal with them so that I don't pass them on to her. And that's something that you have to do very consciously as an adult, so that you don't accidentally teach your child these negative ways of interacting with the world around them. She loves worms. She loves ladybirds. She loves snails. Yeah, you know what? Sometimes she may accidentally kill one or two of them. But it's all part of her experience of learning responsibility, of learning about the world around her, about learning how strong she is, how to take risks, how to be independent, when to ask for help. And all those things are just so important for her. And it all comes within this framework of nature that as a parent, you have to be conscious of so that you can just let them discover it on their own and have a genuine, authentic relationship with it.
Well, in a kind of a way, she's almost teaching you certain things that you're having to change your behaviour and your behavioural patterns in certain ways to accept and find a way to not get freaked out by spiders and things. So she's changing you, which, of course, a child will always do with a parent, hopefully, in a way. So I find that fascinating. So it's very much a symbiotic relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a really exciting one as well. So many parents actually say that their biggest problem they face when they want to interact with their child in a natural environment is that they have a fear that their child is going to ask them a question that they can't answer. Because as parents, we feel like we need to know all the answers to everything. And the best ecologists in the world do not know the answers to all of these questions. And even now, she's starting to point to things and go, what's that? Why is that? How's that? Just little two-word sentences that she's starting to put together. But I can see how when she's 8, 9, 10 years old, that's going to be really challenging because you don't know it all. What my message to parents would be is don't be afraid of that. Just because your kid might end up knowing more than you about some things doesn't mean that you can't go on this journey of discovery together. Research it, make use of encyclopedias, make use of books that you can get them at Christmas, make use of the internet and David Attenborough documentaries if you need to. But researching those things together is a really great way to learn as a family and learn together. And sharing that passion means they're more likely to follow that through into teenage years and not become disenfranchised.
How old is she now?
She's 2.5 now, although I think going on about 15. She keeps going on about a boy called Oscar that I'm a little bit worried is a boyfriend.
Oh, I tell you, things start so much younger these days. Wasn't like that much.
It's really quite scary. I'm sure he's lovely.
It's just the principle. Yes, I totally understand your concerns there. Okay, let's talk about you here. How did your love of wildlife begin? Were you a similar sort of age? Were you brought up with nature and were you taught to love it from an early age? Or was it something you discovered for yourself? And can you remember how, if that's the case?
Oh, so I have a kind of completely contradictory answer here. I spoke to my dad about this not long ago because I really wanted to get into this with him and understand my own childhood in the context of me being an adult now. So up front, neither of my parents are particularly naturey. They're not naturalists, but we did do quite a lot of stuff outdoors together. So walking the dog, I had a grandfather who was typical kind of grumpy Scotsman, but he knew everything about nature, but he never would have called himself a naturalist. This was just stuff that they knew. They could name the trees, they could name the birds, they could name the processes, they understood the rhythms of the season without it being a kind of job title or an aspiration. It was just something that they did, and it was just something that they knew. So they passed that on to me in a kind of symbiotic way, but we never went out on nature walks. We never did specific nature constructed activities. But what they did do is kick me out the front door with my friends when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. I was lucky to grow up in a very safe area where we could go exploring in the spinney behind our house. We once rescued a hedgehog that had got stuck in a wire fence from the local play area and walked it up to the vets, much to the vets' amusement. This group of about 10 9-year-old kids walking in with a hedgehog, all of us covered in hedgehog mites by that point. And we did things like collect snails and make wormeries. They were never framed as nature activities. It was just things that we did because we were bored and because we didn't have loads of other activities to do. It was very unplanned. It was very spontaneous. But we learned it all through osmosis. We fed off each other. And none of those people now are what you would call naturalists, but they're all people who care about the concept of nature. I think that's where it started for me. I learned loads from my parents, especially my dad. But absolutely, he was not trying to teach me. This was not a conscious decision. It was just part of growing up. And I think so many people who were raised in the 70s, the 80s, and the early part of the 90s can understand that. We didn't have structured activities. We didn't care about things like that. It was all to do with fun, play, discovery, independence, adventure, make-believe, imagination, and all of those things were a hugely important part of my childhood that have ultimately fed into the naturalist I am now.
So in a way, you're saying live it and you end up loving it, you end up understanding it, it becomes just part of the natural fabric of your life. You understand what is around you. You don't necessarily, of course, there'll always be questions you want to ask, but you are part of it. And is that what an awful lot of people have missed? And the thing that we are all, everyone who's involved in nature and conservation and wildlife is trying to do, is to try and find a way to reconnect people, to make people part of the fabric of the environment.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think one of the biggest challenges that we do face is that we are very much in a culture and a society now in the Western world that says that we need structure in everything we do. We need goals, targets, ambitions. So if you go out for a family walk, you don't just kind of dawdle along anymore and see where you end up. It's very much like we are going on a family walk. Let's make sure there's lots of photos for Instagram. We need to make sure that everything is packed. We need contingency plans. We need to make sure that the GPS on the phone is working. Has everyone got their phones charged? Do we have the cameras? There's no spontaneity in that. We've lost this idea of just kind of being a bit bored and making it up as we go along. And I think that structure is something that's actually a barrier now to people getting involved in nature. I think we overthink it far too much. We need very structured campaigns to get involved with. We need instruction manuals. We need activity sheets. And I buy into this massively in many respects because a lot of this is what I do for a job. But I do think that in many respects, we're just making it too complicated. And that actually, it is about experiences that we have on the spur of the moment. It's me going running this morning and hearing my first chiff-chaff and going, oh, hurrah, a chiff-chaff. I had a terrible run after that because I was totally distracted and I kept seeing other things, found a random tufted duck for some reason on the canal, not seen one of those there before. And I was watching two stock doves building their nests. And it's those kind of spontaneous things that we miss because we're so desperate to fill every minute of our day with a structured activity that is planned, that has outcomes that we can measure and feel like we've achieved something. And actually, sometimes the greatest achievements in nature are where we achieve nothing whatsoever.
Well, actually, there's so many points in there that I totally agree with. The spontaneity of going for a walk and not knowing where you're going. I love that. I found this place. I do it a lot in Spain. We've got a lot of family and friends down there. And often we'll park the car and we'll just walk. And I love that moment when you go, now, how do we get back to the car and let yourself be a little bit lost? And it's almost as though society has this fear of losing itself, losing oneself in whatever you're doing. You need to know the way out. Always you have to know the way out. Sometimes the greatest things you find are when you come a circuitous route and then go, here we are. That's where I remember this. You know, yeah, OK, nobody wants to get lost permanently, and I'm not advising that. But I do think there is the element of chance gets missed by so many people in the modern world.
Absolutely. And those same things apply when you go out and you have wildlife experiences. So people flock to the Somerset Levels most winters to go and see starling murmurations. And it's always this, well, what's the chances of actually seeing the starling murmuration? And they want kind of statistical analysis of how many are we going to see and what shapes are they going to make? Where exactly do we need to stand? And it kind of strips the excitement out of the entire process. I've got a very good friend, Dick Philby, who set up Rare Bird Alert, and he used to get phone calls all the time from birders. So hardcore wildlife enthusiasts, I would say. And they say, Dick, what are the chances of me seeing this bird if I go tomorrow and I see it? And he'd always say to them, right, well, where do you live, first of all? And they'd say, I don't know, Leicestershire, and let's say the bird's in Oxfordshire, and he'd say, you will not see that bird if you stay in Leicestershire. But there's a chance that you might see it if you go to Oxfordshire. And I think that is just such a wonderful way of looking at the world, is just saying, if you don't take that chance, if you don't have that spontaneity, if you don't allow yourself to have experiences that are unplanned and unmanaged and unpredictable, you could end up missing out on some of the best wildlife experiences that you will ever have. And that's not a message for people who are disconnected from nature. That's a message for people who are totally connected to nature, that we don't need to plan every single activity. We don't need to know exactly where everything is, because spontaneity and excitement and discovery, that word discovery, is just so important and so exciting.
Oh, I agree again. Interestingly, I had one of those moments this morning. I always go to the outdoor fruit and veg market on a Friday in the local town, and when I was driving out, we have a little bridge into our village, and as I was driving out, there was a grey wagtail there, and I had never seen one at our village. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful, really nice chance encounter, and it flew off. I drove back, and there it was again, the grey wagtail on the bridge, and I just stopped the car and just sat there and watched it. It's not a particularly rare bird, but to me, it's one of the most beautiful birds in the world. And it just sat there, wagging its little tail, marching up and down, seemed to accept me at close quarters. And it was just one of those experiential moments that then it flew off, I drove off, and we'd had a chance encounter twice in one morning. And those sort of things just make my day. They really do.
I think they are absolutely everything. And the more that we can share those kind of experiences with people of different ages, people from different backgrounds, making nature genuinely accessible to everybody, and celebrating the different ways that people actually experience nature. I think one of the biggest barriers that essentially the white middle classes have put up to other people experiencing nature is that we say that everyone has to have the same deep and meaningful experiences that we do. And if they don't appreciate nature in the way that we do, then they're somehow not doing it right. This is the curse of nature writing. And don't get me wrong, I love a lot of nature writing. I have huge respect for a huge amount of nature writers from the past 20 or 30 years. But we expect people to have those same profound experiences and those same emotional reactions that we do. And actually, I think that has been such a setback in many respects for allowing people from different cultures, different age groups, different genders to experience nature in their own way. That might mean that they feel different emotions to us. That might mean that they react differently to different stimuli, and that's fine. I think we need to find ways of celebrating all those reactions rather than saying, this is how you will feel when you hear a skylark, or this is how you will feel when you see a butterfly, or you need to go to this small rural idyll to experience what I'm experiencing because I'm doing it right because I'm a naturalist. Sometimes the best wildlife experiences happen to people who are not naturalists, who do not understand the significance of what they're seeing, and that's why they are so marvellous.
Oh, yeah. Again, I agree. We're doing a lot of agreeing here. But it's absolutely true. The one thing somebody always told me about, say, any sort of activity where you're trying to see nature, and I've seen this, and we'll talk about a particular place in a minute, but when I've been to places where there's lots of rare birds turning up or migratory species or whatever, everyone runs around trying to see things, going here, there, left, right, go there, over here. And somebody just said, the best way to watch things is, why don't you just pick one spot and stay there? Because it's amazing how everything comes to you at some point, pretty much, that you don't need to go chasing, because they move quicker than you anyway. So there's every chance, if you're in the right sort of area, that everything will appear at some point or another. And I'll never forget, the classic example of that was at Welney, and there was a twitch on for a blue throat, and we just happened to be down there, and I don't know, there was 60 or 70 people all huddled down one end, and you couldn't actually get to a vantage point to see the bird. And so my wife and I, Jackie and I, who sends her best, by the way, we decided, well, we'll go and do some other stuff. It's been here for a few days. There's every chance it'll appear. When people go, we'll get a chance. And so we went over to an empty hide on the other side of the reserve. And sure enough, we're watching everything. And I swear to God, on this rush, in front of where we are, the only people in this hide, comes this blue throat. And it stays there for about 20-odd minutes. And it was just fantastic because I can see the other group of people in the hide in the distance through my binoculars. And you can see people pointing left, right, centre. And there's obviously a discussion, no, 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 it's over there. No, 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 it's over there. And, you know, I really wanted to wave and let them know, no, 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 it's really over here. And it's that kind of thing. Once you stop chasing is often when you start finding.
I think that is so true, especially in a time of coronavirus. I think a lot of people have learned to appreciate more about what's on their doorsteps and celebrate what's on their doorsteps. I was really lucky to be part of Stephen Moss's book launch, where he has written a beautiful book called Skylarks with Rosie, and it's all about his local patch and about rediscovering that, because he's spent the past 10 years touring around the world and around different parts of the UK. So he's always kind of missed the beauty of spring migration in his own area. And I think so many people really getting to intimately know the wildlife on their doorsteps has been a big revelation in the past year. On the other side of that, I am married to a twitcher who has spent the past year tearing his hair out, other than when he was on the Isles of Scilly in the autumn, because he has felt very trapped in our local patch. He is someone who likes to see new things. He is someone who does instinctively chase. And I get that. I get the excitement of the chase. I understand it. And I've seen over 400 birds in the UK. So obviously I get how people twitch and I understand why people chase. But I do think what you've said is so true, is that sometimes sitting and having a really genuine multi-sensory nature experience will actually lead to something that's more rewarding, and you'll get to see the birds anyway. Understanding behaviour, understanding how a bird is going to react in certain circumstances, understand how mammals are going to react in certain circumstances. That patience of sitting and waiting and enjoying the moment. Cameras, oh my goodness, I have bought a camera and I still can't use it. It's only a little bridge camera, 350 quid jobby. I have no idea how it works. Because in many respects, I don't want to put something else. I don't want to add another layer between me and that natural experience. And there's so much pressure to do that nowadays. Oh, we need the perfect Instagram photo. Oh, I need something to share on Twitter. Oh, I need to grow my following. And that is something that's so tempting to get sucked into. And I have been sucked into it on numerous occasions.
Yep.
But I think that immersiveness is just so important, and exactly what you said, we should just celebrate sometimes just sitting still and waiting for nature to come to us.
Yeah, without a doubt. And you can say that because you've got quite a lot of followers on Instagram, I'll have you know. But no, seriously, it's a fascinating point, this movement or non-movement and just being with nature. And you mentioned a place there that is actually very close to my heart. And I believe it's very close to your heart, the Isles of Scilly. And apparently you should never call them the Scilly Isles, I've heard.
Absolutely, never the Scilly Isles. I actually cringe a bit at the Scillies, but the Scillies is allowable. The Scilly Isles is something that the moment you hear it said on a TV programme, you should just turn off the TV programme immediately. It's like blasphemy. It's a horrible phrase. If you're going to go to the Isles of Scilly, then celebrate it properly with the extra syllable, is what I would say.
Okay, so what is it about those islands? Because they're very much in your heart, aren't they? And actually, you know, I spent many a time with your husband, Rob, on the Isles of Scilly, running around like a maniac with him because he's got much longer legs than me, and had the most incredible times. And it is one of the most extraordinary places and such a well-kept secret. And it'll probably stay that way just because it's a bit of a trek to get to. What is it about them, though?
So there's a number of things that play into it for me with the Isles of Scilly. And I think one of the great things about it is that no matter who you ask, they'll all say something different. For me, it's this marriage of community, of the people there, these very interesting people with these interesting ways of life that are governed not by the normal things that the rest of the world is governed by, but by the tides, by the weather, knowing that you can't get your post because it's foggy. And that's okay, because you just learn to accept that these are challenges and things that you live with. And life there can be incredibly hard for the people who live there in many respects. But on the other hand, it is countered by this incredible beauty. And there's been a lot of research into this recently about how people react to natural landscapes and their perception of beauty and the impact that that can have on your mental well-being. And to me, the Isles of Scilly is quite literally the most beautiful place, definitely in the UK, and the most beautiful place I've ever been to. The landscapes, the colour of the sea, the light, the way that the hills rise out of the sea like little gentle humps, the crags, the rocks, these startling formations, the scattering of literally hundreds of little islands. And then into that, you also get this incredible wildlife that's drawn there by this microclimate fed by the Gulf Stream. So you get to see things that you don't get to see anywhere else. I mean, they've even got their own little subspecies of shrew, which is just marvellous. The song thrushes are bigger and more bulshy, and they sit on your table while you're eating an ice cream and rob your food. Forget the gulls. It's all about the song thrushes. You get huge flocks of sparrows there all chattering away in the hedges. It's not what you call a pristine natural landscape. The place is dripping in invasive species, but there is something about it that is just so diverse and lush and verdant, and it gets under your skin. You can't get away from it, and I've just never been anywhere like that in the UK. Sri Lanka, I thought, was amazing. I've been to a couple of places in Australia that I thought were incredible. To me, I'm always drawn back to those islands 28 miles off the coast of Land's End, because it is like stepping into another world. And some people say it's like stepping back in time. I think that is oversimplified. There are some things that are not great about stepping back in time, and we shouldn't be looking always backwards to the past for solutions. But to me, there is something about it that captures the best of what was and the best of what is, and also gives us the best of what could be for the future. That's just such a lovely feeling, and there is so much to celebrate there and so much to be proud of. And when you start to become ingrained in that community, it's full of these amazing, fascinating and lovely characters. It's just a marvellous all-round package, to be honest.
For me, it's the place that changed my life. I used to go there as a kid every summer. We'd spend probably only 2 weeks, it was three weeks, I think, every summer there. I would always look forward to it. I would consider it my second home, because 3 weeks as a kid, and I think I went there from the ages of about 6 to about 16. It was everything to me. I couldn't wait to get there. I've spent all summer on Scilly. You know, it was one of those things. Of course, it's not true. It was 21 days and probably 19 with all the travel to and from. But it always stayed with me. And then I didn't go there. As we find with people who get lost to various things once they hit the late teenage years and often disappear from the natural world until they're in their 50s, I kind of disappeared from all these sort of places and went off and forged a career as a filmmaker and worked with bands. And it was only after we'd finished a long, lengthy tour with Gorillaz, and I was absolutely exhausted, and I got home and I was kind of drained and really need to re-pressurise, because it deflates. You've just been on the road the whole time. And I remember saying to Jackie, you know, I need to go somewhere that used to mean something to me. And I've never been one who hankers for the past, which is why I was thinking it was interesting when you said we shouldn't always look back to the past for answers for today. But I did look back to the past and found an answer for today, which was I wanted to go back to the Scilly Isles. And of course, I've just said it incorrectly after all the things, and I can probably edit that out. Anyway, I went back to the Isles of Scilly, and it was kind of one of those moments. I got off because you have to, in those days, had to get a helicopter over or a boat called the Salonian, which was a flat-bottom boat, which often would make people so seasick they vowed never to go to the islands again, or they would only go by helicopter. And we decided to go on the helicopter, and it was fantastic. And I just remember stepping off the helicopter after 30-odd years or something, and everything felt so familiar. Not because it was unchanged or whatever, but it was in my DNA. And literally, we got to St. Mary's, the Hugh Town, and then we ended up going up to the Star Castle where we were staying. And everything was exactly where I thought it would be. Of course, it was different, but memories kept flooding back. And it was while I was there that we went out one day and we're wandering everywhere, getting the boats, because you get all these boats to different islands. And we saw some people who were bird watchers. And we were standing in front of this tree and we're watching this bird. And I knew nothing about birds, really. And Jackie and I were watching this bird and I was going, oh, look, that's a sweet bird. I wonder what it is. It's not a sparrow. And then suddenly we shouted, over here, it's over here. And suddenly about 30 people with tripods and binoculars and everything came barging over, pushed us out the way. And we sort of went, oh, that was all a bit strange. And I've got this photo of that moment of all these people on a wall of the garrison on top of St. Mary's and all these people looking at this tree. Later that night, we get into the bar in the hotel and we're having a drink, and this couple walk in and they put their binoculars down on the table and we suddenly start talking to them. I said, oh, maybe you'll be able to help me understand what happened. They listened to me as I told them about the incident. They went, oh, you saw the Blackpoll Warbler. And I went, did I? And it was like one of those moments. I didn't realise, but I was meant to be absolutely amazed by this. And it was just the strangest thing. And I said, what, you mean all these people come over here at this time of year because it's October and it's migratory season and birds get blown off course that shouldn't be here, so all these people come here? And they went, yes, why don't you come out for a day's bird watching with us tomorrow? And so we said, well, okay, yeah, we haven't got anything planned, we're on holiday, let's do it. And we went out the next day and we had a most fantastic day. Yeah, and just sitting in fields, having a Cornish pasty at lunch and things, which are tragically not made on the islands anymore, I found out. But it was a great experience. And I thought, this could be a really interesting documentary. And so I came back the next year with my cameras and started filming the bird world. And it didn't take long before that evolved into finding about conservation issues that birds faced. And that took me into a whole new arena. And it's purely because I went to the Isles of Scilly to decompress or recompress, whichever way you look at it, to get my spirit back. And it gave it to me, and nature gave it to me. So it is one of those things that just really stays with me. Now, you're thinking about moving there, aren't you, at some point in the future? I heard. Is this true?
So, yes, we're in the process of moving at the moment. Legally and technically, I do actually live there already, although we've got stuck back in Leicestershire for lockdown 3.0. It's basically the place that I think I want my little girl to experience as she grows up. The schools there are outstanding. She's part of an amazing nursery community and she's got so many little friends. I think this is where the infamous Oscar lives as well. And I couldn't be a terrible mother and separate them at such a young age, to be honest. So I feel like it's a good parenting decision on my part not to break her heart at such a young age. Incidentally, I can name three places off the top of my head that now make their own Cornish pasties. Although there was a dearth of a few years, there is now, actually, I can think of three places that are making their own. Old Town Cafe, excellent pasties, really good.
Ooh.
And there's all these businesses have sprung up recently. There's a real push on the islands towards creativity and art and music and local crafts, local beers, local food. And it really is just magical. You can pretty much live there with what you've got. There's that much available on the islands that they could almost be self-sustaining if they wanted to be. The farms are all really nature-friendly. There's some amazing farmers there doing some great things because all the fields are so tiny. They used to all be given over to flower farming, so very small fields with big high hedges. And now those same farms are being used for a diversity of growing crops, fruit, vegetables, livestock. There's a couple of vineyards now. And now that these areas are diversifying, it's actually a really good area for experiencing wildlife-friendly farming and how effective it can be. Because these guys are making a good living. They quite often have a campsite attached to what they're doing. The farm, for example, on St. Agnes also makes the best ice cream in the world. One of the other farms is making gin. One of the farms is making like rum and vodka. So they've got all these amazing diversity of things that they offer. But it's also done in a way that's totally in tune with nature. If there's one thing about people who live on Scilly, it's that they really understand what they get from their natural environment and how to give back to it. It's this great relationship that they have with nature. And it comes from respecting nature, from respecting the force of the sea that can cut them off from medical help, that can cut them off from emergency services, that can cut them off from family and friends. And if you get into island life, you understand that it's part of the way that you live. And when you have that innate respect for nature and what it's giving to you in terms of tourism, in terms of opportunities to sell your products, in terms of a hugely beneficial way of life, in terms of health and well-being, when you understand all that, I think you actually respect it more and you want to help it more. So I find a lot of people on Scilly are very good, really celebrating the nature on their doorsteps. I think there's a 50-50 about how much they love us birdwatchers. Some people absolutely hate us and some people absolutely love us. But I can understand why birdwatchers tend to be a divisive bunch at the best of times. But it's a really exciting time actually to go in October. And I think it is marvellous that you rediscovered your connection with nature. And not just that, but it then took you on to be this kind of international conservation campaigner. And it all started with a blackpoll warbler on the garrison. I think that's absolutely outstanding and just something that should be held up and put on a pedestal. I think we should have that on a plaque as you walk through the garrison walls.
Well, I'm touched. I'm feeling quite emotional now. But it is that kind of place. And I don't know, there is something extraordinary about it every time. And we've been talking about, I don't really mind about being stuck away through the whole lockdown period. It's been okay. But if there was ever anywhere, if I had to choose one place that I'm only allowed to visit one place, no other place in the world, it would be Scilly every single time without a shadow of a doubt. So, but how do I put this? You managed to become successfully marooned there, didn't you, during lockdown? Because it is actually, I presume that was okay for you. And what was that like, suddenly having your first taste of long-term island life?
Oh, it was fabulous. So we've done months throughout the year there. We started off going only in October, and then it was kind of, oh, we'll slip in a Easter holiday as well, and oh, when we'll slip in a summer holiday as well. And you find that you're not really going anywhere else. Like you say, it becomes the place that you just keep going back to. And you do fall into this trap of not really visiting any other part of the UK. So in that respect, making the switch for us was quite easy, because then it's like, well, actually, if we make Scilly our home, then that gives you the opportunity to actually go to other places when you have holiday. It's a completely different way of life that I find anyway. I find that I am less materialistic. I am not as bothered about how much money I need to earn in order to have a good way of life, by my own standards and perceptions. Obviously, that's different for everybody, but I find that my own expectations drop. It's slightly slower. I find that I don't get stressed about things. I'm not as worried, oh, did I miss that phone call? Or, oh, did this get done? Did that get done? It doesn't matter. Tomorrow's another day. And I think that attitude is really prevalent on Scilly, and it's a really great way of life in many respects because of that. We went over at the end of September with the view to leaving around the beginning of November, just after my 30th birthday. And we got the news just before that we were going into lockdown 2.0. Now, of course, if you can remember, this was kind of the lockdown that never was. I don't mean that with disrespect to lockdown 2.0, but it seemed like there wasn't an awful lot that you couldn't do other than not get your hair cut, especially compared to lockdowns 1 and 3. So we decided we were going to go for it, and we were going to spend that lockdown there and then go beyond that as well. And we were going to spend all the way through Christmas and into New Year there. It was a marvellous experience, not just because of the wildlife we were seeing, hint goose barnacles washing up, hint humpback whales playing in the roads, which is the area between St Mary's and Tresco, every day from Christmas Eve all the way through for like literally the next 9 weeks they were there. We saw fin whales, there were some great birds late on in the autumn. It was just generally flipping fantastic, to be honest. But more than that, when you see a community like the Isles of Scilly at a time of crisis, you realise just how resilient they are. And it makes you realise how much you want to be part of that and how much you want to give back to it, how much you want to share your experiences with those people and how grateful you are to them for their support and their comfort and the kindness that they're showing you when you're there with them. It was fantastic. I think a lot of people would say, oh, I'm not sure I could live there. And it's not for everybody. It's absolutely not for everybody. But for me, I love that community. I feel very grateful that I've been allowed into it even a little bit, because it's so close and tight-knit and everyone cares for each other so strongly. I think that's something really powerful. And I think it's something we've almost forgotten in so many other areas of life. And it's great that it's being celebrated there.
Okay, well, look, everything that you're talking about is about being part of nature, and it's about nature inspiring us. And, of course, you've always been a strong advocate for the next generation of wildlife enthusiasts and conservationists to be inspired to take part, to find a way. When you started out on your journey after you'd finished university and things, what was it that you started deciding you wanted to do? Because how soon after that was it that you set up AFON, A Focus on Nature, which you co-founded? And explain a little bit about what that is and how it came into being and what was its purpose?
Okay, so that was a lot of questions.
I know,
there,
sorry.
Gary.
Sometimes it makes me feel as though I'm getting through the questions quicker if I chuck about 7 together.
That's fine. Right, no, we can do this. So when I was at university, I did a degree in history, which I personally absolutely love because everyone assumes I'm a scientist. I do not have a qualification in science higher than double award GCSE, which I do think I got an A in, fair dues, but I don't even have like a biology GCSE. My school was not that kind of school. We were more likely to learn about knife crime than we were to learn about the intricacies of chemistry. I went into doing my degree in history with a really open mind and thinking, I'm going to absolutely love learning about the Russian Revolution for the 17th time in my lifetime. And actually, it turned out after 18 months, I really didn't like it. I was very lucky that I was offered the chance to do a module in environmental history. And this brought back all of those things we were talking about earlier, about the childhood experiences, celebrating nature, those things that we did as children. And it took me back to my childhood. It was really exciting. We learned about Beatrix Potter and things like that. Fantastic. And I very clearly remember having a discussion in the class about rewilding. And someone posed like this really controversial question about bringing back wolves. And I knew nothing about rewilding. I knew nothing about ecology. But I remember someone saying, oh, well, what do you think, country girl? Because I grew up in the countryside. So that was a very witty comeback from them. What do you think, country girl, about bringing back wolves? All I could think was, if there is a job that exists in the world that enables me to bring back wolves, I want to do that job. Now, obviously, I now know, with the benefit of hindsight, that the world is a lot more complicated than that. And it's nowhere near that simple. And those are hugely oversimplified ideas. But at the same time, that was my trigger for me, as I realised that that's what I wanted to do for a job. I didn't want to be a teacher like I thought I did. I wanted to work in conservation. And it grew from there. However, because I was doing a degree in history, I was very lucky to have some very good mentors, one of which was Stephen Moss, who him and my husband, Rob, introduced me to you. And the Ghosts Have Gone Bird project, along with a few of my peers, people like Nicola Bolton and a couple of other people who were studying history in the year above me. And those people, some of those people are still my friends now, which is marvelous. We kind of went on this journey of discovery together over the course of a year, maybe, where we realized that we weren't the traditional fit for conservation jobs. And there wasn't an awful lot of coordinated information out there about how to get a job in conservation, what the options were, what the opportunities were. Basically, unless you did a degree in environmental sciences, no one was really providing you with that information. And I went to Bird Fair in, it would have been 2011, I think. And I got chatting to the guys on the Opticron stand, the optical company. And I didn't have a pair of binoculars at that point. I went to the International Bird Watching Festival without a pair of binoculars, which in retrospect seems rather heinous. And they said to me, well, let's talk about this. And essentially, a focus on nature was a bit of a marketing strategy in a way for them to get their products into the hands of young people. It very quickly developed after I'd finished university alongside Stephen Moss and Pete Gamby from Opticron and Rob Lambert, who's now my husband. We very quickly realized that we wanted to develop a focus on nature into something that was so much more than just giving people kit. We wanted it to be about mentoring and events and social networking and conference building and things like that. And there were all these really exciting opportunities to link kids up with each other and teenagers up with each other in a way that no one was. There was at that point no coordinated network for young nature conservationists. So you could feel very isolated. There was no one to talk to about your experiences other than people much older than you who couldn't necessarily empathize. And AFON came from there completely. We grew a committee that was all people below the age of 30. We got funding from a number of sources. We grew the membership very quickly from just a handful of people up to, I think, like 3,000 people have been through the scheme in one way or another now, whether that's just through taking part in the social media activity or through going to events or conferences or through benefiting from mentoring or getting some free kit or benefiting from books, whatever it is that they need. A Focus on Nature has become a really good organization that represents the voices of young people within the conservation movement, largely taking a mentoring view. Other organizations have sprung up now that are focused more on campaigning or environmental issues, and there's various local elements to this as well. So it's kind of spawned this wider conversation about how we get young people interacting with nature. Because there was just such a fear, I think, that there were no young people coming through. And it just wasn't true. I look back now and I can't figure out where this myth came from that young people aren't interested in nature. Because it's never been my experience. They just needed a touch of coordination and an umbrella movement to empower them and give them a voice. And that has massively paved the way, especially with the big organisations, the RSPB, the BTO, the Wildlife Trusts, and the funding bodies as well, people like HLF. They now really understand the importance of encouraging young conservationists into these careers, providing them with proper support and enabling them to do this in ways that are more than just tokenistic, but really meaningful opportunities for developing skills and knowledge. And now what we see is young people being drafted onto charity boards, so they're actually becoming trustees at the age of 18, which is a huge step change in the past 10 years. We're seeing loads of different camps springing up all over the place where people can go and go bird ringing for a whole weekend or learn new skills like surveying. People are taking part in competitions. Young people are now writing magazines completely from scratch. And what I see is people below the age of 35 now leading the charge of creative conservation, challenging the way that people have been doing it for the past 100 years, and really shaking the boundaries. And to me, that all started 10 years ago with a very small network that wasn't particularly ambitious at the time, but that it has just spread and spawned. And by no means is everything under the banner of A Focus on Nature now. But that's the best thing about it. It's so organic and it's owned by young people and they own it as individuals. And it's everything about that is just wonderful and should be celebrated. Sorry, that was so effusive there.
No, it's absolutely fine, because I don't think there's anything wrong with what you said in the slightest. I think what people should take from this is that there is a generation of people and a generation underneath them that are more vocal than we've had in so many years. And certainly there feels like there's a sense of empowerment for younger people within the conservation world. My concern is that there still aren't enough jobs for the amount of people now there are out there who want to take part. I mean, does that worry you, that conservation jobs are limited? And how do we take the lock off the chains, as it were?
Oh, absolutely. I think it is terrifying how few jobs there are in conservation, and also, bluntly, how badly paid they are. The conservation industry has relied inherently for 100 years on volunteering. What this means by its nature is that a certain type of person can readily volunteer. They have to have enough time and disposable income to afford to volunteer, to afford to contribute. And that puts barriers up for lots of different people, whether that's women who will not prioritise their own wants and needs. So women are less likely to volunteer in many respects because they're prioritising their family life, they're prioritising their work, they prioritise what they need to do around the house because it feels like a luxury to be allowed to volunteer. You get less ethnic minorities because they don't have role models within volunteering. They don't see people who look like them, which I think is a huge barrier that is completely underappreciated at the moment within the conservation sector. And we have huge class issues as well, with essentially you end up with only middle class people being able to do it because they're the ones who can afford to do it. And this is a self-perpetuating problem. We have now created a conservation movement that is reliant on people like that to make the smallest and most insignificant of changes happen. Things like managing a wildflower meadow can take 20 or 30 volunteers, and that seems a disproportionate amount of time to put into an acre of land or something. So how we change that is a huge challenge going forward. When I was working at the Wildlife Trust, we would get maybe 70, 80, 90 applications for a job in communications at the lowest paid level. And those applications would range from being completely underqualified to completely overqualified. We'd have people with PhDs applying for a 16 grand a year job, which just seems utterly ridiculous in many respects. But the jobs simply aren't there. There are huge problems with the way that conservation is structured. There are huge problems with the way that it's accessible. I think a lot of the jobs are created quite reactively rather than strategically. So person A has too much work on their hands, so we'll just employ someone else to pick up the rest of their work at a lower level, rather than maybe reassessing what our priorities are and working out, actually, is every single thing that this person's doing useful? And I think actually the underpayment is a huge issue as well. It's very hard to get the best and right people doing the jobs for nature if you're not paying them the best possible money. And if you're not paying them the best possible money, by default, you're never going to get necessarily the best people to do those jobs. I've seen that an awful lot, and I don't mean that with disrespect to many, many people, but the opportunities for training and skills development really needs to be invested in the conservation movement, so that we can help people grow, help people move forward, help people develop their careers. Because it's when people feel empowered in their jobs and feel like they're making a difference that they will make a difference. Otherwise, you just end up with loads of people who are a bit disenfranchised, completely overworked, working 60 hours a week. I mean, I got an email from someone the other day at 1:40 in the morning, and that's not okay. Like, we shouldn't have a conservation movement that thinks it's okay for people to be working at 1:40 in the morning just to make the smallest, most insignificant of changes. That's not on. And I think that the conservation movement as a whole need to take a good, long, hard look at itself and say, are we actually using our resources in the best possible way that's most effective for nature? Or actually, could we do with complete restructures, complete shakeups, and complete challenges to the way that we've been working that will ultimately lead to happier staff, hopefully more staff, because you'll end up generating more income, attracting a more diverse range of people into those roles rather than just the same old people who've had the privilege to just volunteer for 10 years to get enough experience on their CV before anyone will employ them. And how do we make use of all of these people who are so desperate to contribute something when we simply don't have the resources to pay them? It's a huge challenge. I'm not saying I have the answers to all these questions, but I can't help but point out the problems.
Well, the problems are you've got the work that needs to be done. You've got the jobs that could be created because of the work that needs to be done. You've got the people who want to do the work that needs to be done in the jobs that have been created for the work that needs to be done, but you don't have the money. And this is the fundamental problem with all conservation. For some reason, we all know that the world is in a parlous state. We all know now after lockdown that people feel the benefits of being in nature in whatever small fashion, finding themselves in a green space. And yet, the bodies that run this world do not see that nature and conservation is a viable option to plough money into. I mean, we are now living with a government, and this isn't about a particular government. This is really aimed at all governing bodies around the world. But this government did promise to leave the environment in a better state for the next generation. But they haven't assigned a huge amount of money to nature. Okay, some grants have been made for various trusts, but was it enough? Quite probably not. Do we have to lay the blame at government's doors and politicians' doors? Because it also seems to me that when you watch conservation groups, NGOs in action, I've been to fundraisers, and I won't say who, but I've seen three or four different conservation groups all fighting for the same donors, mm-hmm. and the donor is only going to donate to one of them. It can be one of the most vicious businesses in the world when you see what happens at close quarters. I find it terrifying. And actually, half the time, when you raise money for them, it's almost like, oh, I thought it would be more. It always needs to be more. I don't blame conservation groups for needing more, but I do blame the structures that we live in, that for some reason we don't attach importance on feeding and nurturing the world itself.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think there's a lot of pro-killism in conservation as well. I mean, feeding in from what you've just said there, this competitiveness for individual pots of money. I think this individual pots of money can be a huge problem because of where they come from. And it's one of the reasons why I started to become disenfranchised with the whole bloody thing, to be honest. Was because someone in, I don't know, DEFRA or maybe Natural England, unlikely because they don't have any money, but let's say someone in DEFRA or someone in one of the big funders, so HLF, not PPL actually, People's Postcode Lottery are outstanding at funding core work. They are really, really good at that. But your other kind of charitable foundations and trusts, they sit around a board table and they come up with a really good idea with good intentions. And they decide that they're going to fund projects. And I hate that word so much because so much time is spent planning the project and working out the branding for the project and setting targets for the project and reporting on the project that it makes you question how many hours of that person's time who is employed for, say, 3 years is actually spent delivering the project. And that project will inevitably end. Because the money will run out and they'll move on to something bigger and sexier because they're driven by press releases and PR exposure and how many different places their logo's got in, rather than being driven by the actual outcomes of we're trying to save the natural world. The money is there. The money is locked up in individual donors, in major donors. The money's locked up in companies who could be investing in nature. The money's locked up in trusts who have the money. It's in the bank accounts. But I think there are so many barriers to people accessing it because everything is so project-based and you spend days and days and days of your life putting together a bid that is highly competitive in nature. You've got maybe a 1 in 10 chance of winning it. There's a huge amount of celebration for the one organisation that wins it. And then what happens to everybody else? What happens to all that time that's been wasted? That's your membership money that's been wasted, being forced to compete, to dance, to jump through hoops, to jump up and down saying, look at me and my fancy branding. Isn't this so important? And actually, that's all money that could have gone into actual targeted conservation work. And I think this is a huge problem. One credit to HLF, actually, because I feel like I'm ragging on them, and I'm not. I think they're a great organisation. They are actually really taking the issue of diversity seriously now. And I think this is hugely important. They are really understanding that you cannot parachute white saviours into diverse communities and expect that to enact meaningful change. And I think that's a really important point that they're finally getting their head around, and they're really listening to advocates in this area. So credit to them where it is due. But this whole idea of project-based working, I am hugely sceptical about, because I think we know the answers. I think we know what we need if we are to restore nature. We need more land that is more protected, that is more joined up, that's more accessible by diverse communities who can then go on to champion nature in their own lives. We need more individual action. We need more businesses taking action and stop doing damaging activities. And we need more politicians championing nature in the House of Commons and the House of Lords, so that we can actually put all of these things into practice. We do not need another parochial project that has a one-year lifespan where there's going to be someone employed, where they're going to spend 3 days a week answering emails, attending meetings they don't need to be in, and reporting on something that's going to be dead within a year. It doesn't make any sense to me. I find it endlessly frustrating, and I feel so sorry in a way for the organisations that have to dance to these tunes or they do not get any money.
This is just why we have to continually have these conversations, and hopefully people who are listening to this will start to understand exactly what's going on, that we all need to find a way to help conservation. And it is down to us, I'm afraid, until there's a limitless fund of money just turned on tap by the governing bodies. It is down to all of us to try and do a little bit, even if it's only simple things like planting trees in the gardens that bees can pollinate. There's little things. And I think little things is a very important message for people, especially after everything we've been through, because gardens have seemed to have been tended better. People have made discoveries along the way. It has been an incredibly strange past year or so, but there are things that have come out of this that's positive. Now, we're running out of time here, but there is one subject I'd like to broach with you. We have had a lot of discussion about sexism in nature, the way women are treated. And for an amount of people, they go, really? Can that be happening in this day and age? And it does seem as though history is repeating itself. I mean, have you had, and I know you've written about this, but what is your feeling towards the attitudes of women in nature that you've come across, and your thoughts on it?
Oh, so this is a very complicated one for me, so I'll try and sum it up quite succinctly. I have experienced sexism in the nature conservation professional industry. I wouldn't say that I ever experienced what you would call sexual harassment. I was never made to feel uncomfortable. I think that the people who work in conservation are on the whole a very good bunch, and I've always had amazing friendships within there. But during my own maternity leave, I experienced something from my employer that could only be defined in reality as discrimination. And that discrimination was based on the fact I'd had a baby. And given that babies can only come out of one gender, I would have to call it sexism in reality, because that kind of circumstance wouldn't occur with a biological male. So I didn't have great experiences towards the ends of what I would call my professional career in conservation. The great thing is that I've gone on to be freelance. I set everything up before I left my job so that I had the resources and the power within myself to go freelance. And it's been an amazing experience. And I feel like my time is so much better spent now. I don't spend my time listening into meetings that I'm not contributing to, and I don't have to worry about what everyone else is doing, because I spend my time really valuably contributing to a bigger cause. So that has been a really powerful move for me. On the other side of it, there's this really interesting conversation going on about the issue of sexual harassment and safety, which is more to do with being outside in natural spaces, not even necessarily within nature, but in the great outdoors. That has been very well covered when it comes to urban environments. We're talking about the abduction and murder of Sarah Everard and hundreds of other women who get attacked, murdered, harassed in urban spaces. The story in rural spaces has been far less told. And in March this year, I published a piece on bird guides, which really went into the details of how women approached their own safety when they were out exploring nature, when they were out bird watching. And there were some really powerful stories in there from women saying that they had faced sexual harassment when they were out in nature, that they had felt stared at, that they had felt taunted, that they had felt targeted or unsafe, that we sit there walking with our keys between our fingers at times because we don't know who that person is in front of us. And it could be a guy. And yeah, you know what? We hear it all the time. Oh, it's not all men. Yeah, of course it's not all men. Of course it's not. But you know what? It could be any man when it comes to being a woman. You just don't know. And knowing that you're probably not as fast, you probably can't overpower them, and you probably can't protect yourself when it comes down to it. They all feed into this psyche of keeping yourself safe. After I wrote this piece for Bird Guides, there was this amazing outpouring of support, particularly, and I full credit here, from the male birding community, who were shocked by what I'd said, shocked by some of these female testimonies, and who said, right, we're not standing for this anymore. We are going to make a concerted effort to ally ourselves to you and to make these spaces as safe for you as they are for us. And that was an amazing reaction, actually. I was so heartened and humbled by the feedback that I got. Yeah, there were a few idiots who exercised their entitled privileged rights and tried to message me or undermine me. And I just wasn't having it, frankly. I usually take a certain amount of that when I write, but not this time. I wasn't having it at all. I wasn't in the mood. It really was a powerful experience, a very empowering experience to share these stories and be part of this movement of women speaking up and saying, no, we're not going to have this anymore. And to have so many men support our messaging was really great. The RSPB came out within a week and said, yep, we completely support everything you're saying here, and we're going to make our nature reserve safer. The birding community said, we are going to make our nature reserve safer. This was so exciting that suddenly everyone was listening to this conversation, and it was all to do with timing. It really was all to do with timing. I've been talking about this sort of thing for years and no one's really paid any attention, but suddenly this is on the agenda.
But don't you think it's a terrible shame that actually it takes the death of a woman being snatched from a London street to end up having this discussion, that we have to have it because of something like that, when really this should be the agenda? As you said, you've been writing about this for years. Is that not disappointing in itself? It's great we're having the dialogue, but this does seem to be a perpetual repeat situation.
Absolutely. I do think it's very disappointing that these conversations only come around when they're interesting to the media. And I think we underestimate how important the media is in deciding what is on the agenda and what is not. So many women get attacked, kidnapped and murdered, frankly, in this day and age. In the UK, we're not talking about countries in far-flung places. We're talking about right on our doorsteps here. And the difference is with the Sarah Everard case that the media got involved very quickly, and that this was raised very high up the agenda, and therefore it was raised high up the political agenda as well. I don't know quite what the coming together of circumstances was that brought that about, but it's the same as kind of Madeleine McCann. All it takes is one catalyst. I can't even express enough my sympathy for what her family and friends must be going through. It must be horrendous. But what was really shocking was how her story was something that every woman I know could relate to, because we could all empathise so deeply with the fear that she must have felt. And it sparked this movement of women saying no. But I mean, this is following on from the Me Too movement, which wasn't very long ago at all. And you're thinking, we're still having the same conversation. Why? Why does it take so many people jumping up and down saying, hi, can we not sexually harass women, please, before anyone actually pays any attention? We're not asking for the moon here. It's quite a basic human right, to be honest. I don't even know why this subject is considered controversial in many respects. But however frustrating it is that this conversation hasn't happened before, and however disappointing it is, I am someone who looks to the future, which is ironic for a historian, I recognise. And I say, what I hope is that this does spark meaningful change. And to me, the meaningful difference I have seen within the nature community, so taking it more inward looking towards the nature community, is that I think this will bring about change. I think that people have listened. I think that a number of men who work in nature reserves have gone home and they've talked and they've genuinely listened to their wives, their children, their sisters, their aunties, their cousins, and they've gone, we never believed it was as bad as you said it was, but we now understand that one incident is one incident too many, and this is not okay. We need you to find solace and safety in nature reserves the same that we do. And to me, that is so exciting. I mean, I do want to emphasize that I do not believe that sexual harassment is rife within the birdwatching community. I don't think it is, to be honest. I think I know so many really decent, marvelous human beings, most of whom are male, in conservation and in birding. And they are genuinely good guys. And they're the guys that are sitting up and listening and taking this seriously. And I think that is something that we should all get behind, no matter what your gender, no matter what your race, no matter what your religion. I think we should all be getting behind this and celebrating this and stamping out these misogynistic and also racist or homophobic attitudes that exist, because they no longer have a place if we are going to genuinely make the change that we need to see in society for nature.
Well said. And I would say that these subjects need people like you with strength of character and the ability to articulate the emotion, the feeling, the thought, so that everybody can understand. So I thank you for that. Right, look, we are out of time. I've got about 8 more pages of questions for you, but it's just not going to happen. We'll have to think about doing Lucy McRobert part 2.
See how many listeners you get on this one first.
This has been absolutely fantastic having you on here. The time has flown by. We've covered so many subjects. There were so many more to talk about, but please take our thanks with you, because Lucy McRobert, you are a conservationist.
Thank you very much, Kerry.
Conservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about conservation and conservation conversations at conservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at conservation. Conservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.